What's that? It's the sound of a bird singing outside.
Is it spring?
I don't know, but the White Witch's grip on the land is loosening. There's a rumour that Aslan may be on the march.
It is spring! It is... What?
Not officially.
Oh, don't spoil it.
Oh, sorry.
It is spring, Effie.
Okay.
And this is podcast season 4, episode 4 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Gary Walker.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Efrain Hernandez.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Jonathan Roberts.
And in this episode, we've got lots of lightning news about Arch, Ubuntu, Raspberry Pi, OpenStreetMap, and that other thing that I can't remember. We've all been busily discovering things this fortnight. We've got angriness, and we've got joy, and rants and raves. We also have Speak Your Brains and Open Ballot. What now? Yes, if that sounds good, you can you can buy a paper version of the podcast in the form of Linux Format Magazine, and there's a really great subscription offer up there at tinyurl.com/lxfoffer1. It's really good.
We haven't found out what it is yet.
No, we haven't, have we? That should be one of our discoveries for next fortnight.
That's a good
idea.
I've
discovered what the podcast subscription offer actually is.
Awesome. So, time for the news. And first up is a great piece of news this week, this fortnight, whatever. Arch's 10th birthday. Arch Linux's 10th birthday.
Fantastic. I really wonder where it was for those 7 years that I never knew about it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, totally.
It kind of feels like it's one of those, it's kind of reached critical mass and loads of people are into it now and it's just growing.
Yeah, the Raspberry Pi version.
Yeah. First version, I think it was called Homer, if I'm not mistaken from what I read this morning.
As in Homer Simpson?
I don't know. Maybe Homer as in who wrote the Iliad. I don't know.
That would be cooler.
What, Iliad or Homer Simpson?
The Iliad.
Homer Simpson must be referencing the Iliad.
If the next version, if the next versions were called, called things like Catullus and Virgil. And
that would be cool.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. Kind of strange that Arch had a version name, the original Arch.
Yes, you're right. are we still on Homer?
I'm not entirely sure. I could be so mistaken about this. So.
You really should. This is the
trouble.
I should
check this sort of thing as a journalist.
With rolling releases, you know, we don't review Arch.
No.
And we don't review Firefox anymore.
No.
But
no.
We should do something on it.
When it reaches 24, which will be in about 2 months' time. And anyway, that's congratulations to all the team at Arch and everyone who uses it. Great distribution, loads of fun, works really well, always up to date. We love it. Next news story, and we've got to be careful how we deal with this because we've been told that we're always a bit too down on Ubuntu and Canonical generally, but Mark Shuttleworth has said that Ubuntu adoption overtook Red Hat Enterprise Linux's adoption.
That's
in
fantastic.
The Enterprise.
Well, well done. Well done, guys.
Well done, Canonical. Well done, Ubuntu.
Enough said.
So does that mean that Canonical is also on the way to making $1 billion this year, like Red Hat are?
I think not.
Oh, don't spoil it, Andrew.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's just because I hate them. I don't really.
I think we should stop there. No, it is good news that Ubuntu is growing and it's actually, you know, the work they put in and the effort they put in is starting to pay off.
And also, I mean, it means if people want to become sysadmins or get a job like that and they have lots of Ubuntu experience, that a lot of those will be transferable to jobs.
Yeah. So, you know, whatever dodgy statistics might have been being quoted, none of us are statisticians here. We'll leave that aside. Just, you know, growth in Linux, whatever form it takes, is good all around. Stay positive this week. Raspberry Pi launch has been delayed. Not the actual launch, it's been launched, but the shipping of the devices have been delayed. Anyone know why?
Gone. Magnets.
Oh, Graham beat you to it.
Sorry, that went badly, didn't it? Andrew stuck up his hand and then I interrupted like a naughty child in class.
I shouldn't really have stuck up my hand, should I? Because this is recorded. No one can see it. Also, my interjection was delayed because there are six of us and we only have four microphones.
Yeah. So Andrew has to walk around the corner to get to the microphone.
Yes, yeah, magnets, isn't it? They were using
what magnets?
They were using the jack socket magnets. They were using south magnets, but they should have been north magnets.
Yeah,
and that was wrong.
I'm looking at Ben because
why is it wrong, Ben?
That's not how I read the news story. Inside the Ethernet connection, there's actually coils that do various wondrous things on the the electrical signals that come in. And on sometimes these are external to the actual jack, in which case you have a jack without magnetics, and sometimes they're internal to the jack, in which case you need a jack with magnetics because they aren't anywhere else. And in this particular case, something happened at the factory. They put in the ones without magnetics, and they needed ones with magnetics.
So did they have to all get shipped back to China and then back here again?
I think so.
Is that actually what happened?
They weren't entirely clear on how far they had come. One obviously had come to the UK.
Somebody got on a walkie-talkie to the tanker. Turn around. Yeah. It takes 6 weeks to turn the tanker around.
Yeah. So, along with all those Honda cars. There's some very angry Honda customers.
They're just in the boot of one of those Honda cars.
At least one of them made it to Cambridge, where they did various things like X-ray it. And actually, if you haven't read the blog post by Raspberry Pi, it's well worth reading, just because they go into exact detail of what's going on. They show the X-rays of the parts, how they found out what the problem was. And it's actually quite interesting.
It is cool how open they are about this. Yeah.
Considering I'm personally waiting for a Raspberry Pi, I'm not annoyed because of how awesome their blog post was.
And they do. How can we be annoyed when it's a charity and they're doing it for free?
Yeah. You
know, it's not Apple.
It's an unfortunate setback for China's fledgling manufacturing industry. as they were getting off the ground.
Yeah.
So that's that. Also in the news, I know next to nothing about this, but NVIDIA have joined the Linux Foundation. Graham?
I don't know much more about it than that, although it's great news. I mean, the Linux Foundation, it's a rather exclusive club, and it also reaffirms NVIDIA's commitment to Linux and free software.
So do you think we're going to see open source NVIDIA drivers? Are NVIDIA going to get in on the... What's the driver called?
Nouveau.
Nouveau. Mm. Do you think NVIDIA are going to start helping out with Nouveau?
Yeah, I don't think they'll ever open source their proprietary controlled secret schemes for fast graphics. But... I don't see why they can't help the Nouveau driver people in developing a better driver on their terms. And also things like OpenCL. I mean, they're very open about that. And, you know, Linux is used in professional environments with NVIDIA hardware, you know, and it's great that we've got better vendor support.
I suppose as well, with things like Android and lots of Android phones starting to use the Tegra chipset, which is ARM-based processing, their involvement will only improve Linux's capability on those sort of
and
chipsets.
It's great to see, you know, NVIDIA are a big company. It's great to see them, you know, sticking with Linux.
So does anyone actually know what the Linux Foundation does?
They build foundations for things.
They like standards.
Yeah, are they a standards group?
They do standards, do they, anyone?
Do they do the LPI?
I don't think so.
They don't do the LPI. In fact, they do their own training.
Yeah, they employ a few of the top kernel developers.
Right, yeah, because GKH moved there recently.
To stop them from being... To keep them vendor neutral, to stop any one company...
Isn't Linus employed by the Linux Foundation?
I was trying to remember that. I'm not sure.
I think he is now.
Okay, and so finally, OpenStreetMap is gaining a lot of popularity. For anyone who doesn't know, OpenStreetMap is like Google Maps, but also like Wikipedia, and people have gone around with their GPS devices, their phones, and just record and upload the maps and tag it all. And now there's an amazingly detailed map of the world made by individuals, and it's got, you know, walking routes, cycling routes, it's got elevations. And
none of it has been cynically exploited by large corporations.
Or has it? Go on, Graham.
I don't know. What are you going to say?
In the news in the last few weeks, it's been turned out that OpenStreetMap have been used by Apple, which is cool. I like big companies using it. And also Foursquare have switched to it and things. But Apple haven't been crediting for the maps, which has caused a little bit of controversy. But as far as I know, OpenStreetMap put up a post saying they welcome Apple's use of it. So.
Yeah, I mean, if Apple use it as their default mapping system and find some way of contributing back to the quality of maps that people use, which I imagine they will, because people
maybe
will demand...
Maybe an improved tile set or something like that.
Well, at least the location of every Starbucks cafe. That's what Apple users need to know.
Yeah. It's kind of... We're not stereotyping. It is pretty accurate and all that kind of stuff, though, with the location of restaurants and parks, and very, very good.
It's brilliant that kind of information's in the public domain. Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it before, maybe a couple of years ago, but I find it deeply frustrating that the taxpayer pays for the Ordnance Survey maps in the UK, and while they have gone a long way with their open data in opening up things like the highest resolution maps aren't available, which is very frustrating.
Yeah.
Isn't the Ordnance Survey a government body, though?
Yes.
Which is why it should be open. Have we paid for it?
Oh, I see. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Ben, you've got downloaded, because with Google Maps, you obviously have to have a data connection, but with OpenStreetMap, you can download offline.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a few, I use it on my Android phone, and there's a couple of different apps which just allow you to download massive chunks of it and just store it on your phone. I've got one which is a complete roadmap of the UK, so I don't need a data connection.
If you're travelling abroad in, say, Spain or Barcelona, yeah. And you know, you don't want to be racking up massive data bills. Yeah.
I also have one that does the same with Ordnance Survey maps, and I'm not entirely sure that's legal.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, you can join Effie in via legal Android app corner.
Welcome to the club.
Well, that is the end of the news this fortnight.
Okay, so this is a time when we talk about the things that we've been learning about this week, or this fortnight, in fact. So, to welcome our new podcaster, I'll hand over to Gary to see what he's learned.
Well, this month I've discovered Linux.
Hey!
Well, God. Mere 6 months after starting work as the production editor of the Fine Organ.
Has it been that
Linux
long?
Format. It has.
Six months?
My life. Six short months.
Preposterous.
I haven't had much time yet between producing three issues at the same time, cleaning the toilets and trying to arrange free holidays to Portugal. But you can follow my travails on tuxradar.com, where at the moment there's a thread with 38 comments. So thank you for your helpful pieces of advice. I did, however, ignore them all and write a list of all of the distros we featured on the cover disc in the last 6 months, put them into my magic randomising bag, a.k.a. a magazine mailbag, and draw one out at random. And that was our Ubuntu remix from issue 155 with GNOME 3. And I've had a bit of a play with it so far. I've managed to download a few things and work with a few applications like Banshee, GIMP. Had a look around the Ubuntu Software Centre and played a few rounds of Super TuxCart, which gave me mild motion sickness. And it's all going really well. I'm enjoying it. It's good.
What about the shutdown button?
Oh, you've got me angry now. I don't understand why you need to hold down the Alt key, or why you would make the assumption you need to hold down the Alt key in order to shut down. This may be very cross. Although you've assured me this isn't due to Ubuntu, it's the shell.
It's due to GNOME, yeah.
Due to GNOME.
It's received a lot of hate.
So that is my my one negative point thus far.
Was that part of GNOME's drive towards usability?
Yes.
Infuriating. I just don't understand.
The idea behind it is that suspending is better and faster than shutting down.
But it doesn't work.
But they said rather than hiding suspend, they said the right thing to do is to put suspend up front and fix the problems with suspend on different systems.
By all means, fix it and make it work. But
give us a choice.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah.
Give you the option, absolutely.
I mean, all that's going to happen is I'll be pressing my reset switch and then deleting the hibernation partition when I come back to restart my machine.
So tune in next time to find out what has come out of my magic randomising bag.
Excellent.
Okay, Graham, do you want to tell us what you've discovered this week?
Yeah, sure. I've got a pretty cool discovery. The project has been going on for a while, but it just released 0.120, and it's a project called OpenMW, which is a recreation of the Morrowind game, which is from like 10 years ago, I think. Morrowind is the prequel to Oblivion and Skyrim, both massive open-ended role-playing games. I like role-playing games. I did play Morrowind and Daggerfall, its predecessor, and it's great that it's got extra life as an open-source project. You do need to have the original Morrowind game because it uses it for its data and game logic, and OpenMW is a reconstruction of the game logic, the game mechanism, you know, the game engine. They use things like Ogre, and they also use Bullet, which I hadn't quite realised just how awesome it is. Bullet is a free software physics engine library, and it's used by all kinds of people, and it's used by Hollywood for films.
Really?
Like I've written them down actually. It was used in Hancock at the A-Team and the Sherlock Holmes movie, and it's used in games like GTA 4 and Red Dead Redemption, and it's
awesome.
And it's completely open source physics engine. And that's it. So my discovery is OpenMW followed by Bullet, really.
Can you use a physics engine without necessarily building a full 3D environment and stuff? Is there anything cool you can do that's reasonably simple?
Well, I don't know, and I'm going to look into it because it might be worth covering.
Yeah,
but the videos that Bullet have got on YouTube have got like 61,000 cubes piled on top of one another, and then they just, in real time, it renders, like, using OpenCL, actually, on NVIDIA and ATI hardware, you can watch it in real time. collapsing and creating this massive mess. Now, maybe there's a Python binding. Maybe there's some easy way of getting stuff like that to get some nice effects out of it. And so I'll have a look into it and see if we can do it.
Yeah, maybe if it links into Blender.
Yeah, it is actually used in Blender. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, so you can use it in Blender probably without a single line of code. But I don't know what... I mean, it's probably easier to code than try and get it to work in Blender.
Quite possibly, yeah. Okay, John, what have you been looking into?
I had this crazy idea that for a feature for next issue, I would try and make my own computer, or at least the basics of my own computer, out of transistors and resistors, and build it up and actually understand how the craziness, like how crazy, that, you know, electricity, just like flowing electrons, can be used to store and remember and memorize data and then do operations on it. And that's all it is. How does that work? So I found this program called KTech Lab, which actually lets you simulate circuits on it. So you
can, is that a KDE application?
It is a KDE application. I'm still using KDE. I'm still using it. And you can drag and drop the components onto it. So transistors, all the different kinds of transistors, MOSFET and NPN and PNP and all the different kinds. And you can drag them around and put them in and connect them up with wires and resistors and capacitors. And so I've used it. I've built some logic gates. I've built AND gates and OR gates and NOT gates and an XOR gate. And I built a full adder and a half adder to start, and a full adder. I've just finished this morning building a 2x2-bit piece of RAM.
Awesome.
I don't know how far I'm going to get covering this in the future, but it's just so fascinating and so fun. You know, get KTech Lab and give it a go and just play around and make some cool stuff. It's very good.
Look forward to the feature.
Yeah, I'm really
it's
enjoying
it. It's going to be in 158, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, Effie, what have you been finding out?
Yeah, I discovered an add-on for Mozilla Firefox web browser called Coalition. What it does basically allows you to see online who's tracking you in real time when you visit the website. And what it does, it creates a map of the websites that are tracking you linked to the cookies, the third-party cookies that are stored locally in your computer, so they share this information with each other. Say, for instance, you're visiting the TuxRadar website. You can see the TuxRadar website as a circle, as a glowing circle on the map, and all the other websites that are tracking you, that are seeing where you're moving, where you're going. And funny enough, I visited my Facebook profile website, and no one was tracking me apart of Twitter. It was really weird. Then I went to the FBI homepage, and there were a couple.
See if your picture is still up there.
Exactly. Yeah, and it wasn't. I've been captured, apparently. So there were a couple of websites tracking my movements on the FBI website. So I closed that tab. Everything works on tabs. You can still have all the tabs open, and then the map redraws on its own. So I closed the FBI website tab, and I went to a different website, a Mexican news website, and the FBI was tracking my movements at that point.
You sound surprised.
Yeah, I thought the add-on doesn't do anything. Only displays who's tracking you, who's seeing your movements, and you can get other add-ons to block all those people tracking you. I don't know what you're surfing, what you're viewing. It's called Coalition.
So I'm slightly annoyed about that discovery, because I spent several hours earlier this week creating my own way of doing that.
sorry to burst your bubble.
Oh well. I didn't have a nice map though, so I'll check it out.
It is cool, because it's something you notice from time to time just when you're browsing around generally. So, like, I was doing a little bit of shopping online the other week, and now for days afterwards, I keep seeing adverts for what I was shopping for on completely unrelated websites. Yeah. And
you see, but this is a scary thing, isn't it? If you're doing online banking, you probably do want to see who's trying to track you when you're doing this sort of.
I mean, you should hope that not when we're doing it on online banking, should be all secured. But yeah, it's good to know. It is good to know.
Yeah,
that was my discovery.
Yeah. Okay. Andrew, have you discovered anything else that completely wipes out part of my day earlier this week?
Not unless you're a taxpayer of the city of Montreal.
Damn it! Yes!
Yes, my awesome discovery is that after the 1976 Summer Olympics in Montreal, which the bill for for hosting it wasn't paid off until 2006. Because the estimate, the actual cost of hosting the Olympics spiraled so far out of control that it reached $1.2 billion in 1976. To put that in context, the Atlanta Olympics, which was in 96, only cost $1.8 billion. And because they built everything from scratch rather than just refurbishing stuff and giving things a lick of paint.
Like we've done,
yeah. That's the moral of the story, which we'll come to. and they've got loads of white elephant stadiums that are falling to bits, I can't remember whether it was the Quebec or the Montreal local government decided that they'd pay it off with revenues on a tax on smoking. But then they banned smoking. so it took even longer to pay off. Oh, dear me. Anyway, that's the discovery. And I wonder if anyone can see any parallels there with what our cousins in London are doing.
Can I... sorry, Ben.
So the moral of the story is we should reintroduce smoking in pubs for this Olympics.
Reintroduce smoking in pubs in London. Because it's just London Council tax that's paying for the games, isn't it? It's not all of us.
Did that happen in the Beijing Olympics? Because they built everything from scratch.
Yeah, they're later.
They did, but they have huge amounts of money and slave labour.
Can I just take us on a slight, even bigger digression when we're already on? Did anyone else see that... I don't know if we have time for this. Anyone else see that there's plans from George Osborne to introduce 100-year bonds?
Yes.
And possibly even perpetual bonds. How cool. I love this idea. It's how we paid for the First World War. We issued these perpetual bonds that you just pay interest on rather than ever actually paying off the debt. And eventually, as time goes by, the interest trends towards zero, as GDP grows or something. Eventually, the debt just disappears. So you just pay interest for about 100 years, and then the debt's gone and disappeared.
I guess it's just a different form of printing money.
Yeah, it is, basically. But it's getting other people to give you the money, and you just pay them interest for... It's basically a student loan for countries.
That sounds like securitization, but on a national scale.
I'm not sure what securitization
is. It's where you know you're going to... Say David Bowie did it back in, I don't know, however long. He knew that he had a huge back catalogue of 20 or 30 albums. He knew that over the next 10 years, he expected that they'd sell for...
Yeah, this is basically what it is.
He'd make about 20 million quid off them.
Yeah.
So... I think he sold the rights of for the next 10 years to some bank via this financial instrument called a securitization. But he sold that for like 19 million or something. Yeah. So he got the money up front.
Yeah.
And whatever bank or financial institution got £1 million profit.
I think that's more or less the idea
of it. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
What could go wrong?
Paid off the First World War.
Paid off the First World War and also led us into an enormous banking crisis.
No, because that wasn't part of a banking crisis.
But when bonds get bonds don't just get traded once. They get sold and resold and sold again.
That is true. Yeah, it's kind of cool. Well,
I mean, I might be massively naive, but taking on debt you're never going to pay off seems like a bad idea.
Well, no, because you are paying it off, but you're paying it off through interest, and eventually it just disappears, because we'd be paying interest anyway. And the idea is that we're paying, 2% interest on our debt at the minute. And if we issue these, 100-year or perpetual bonds now at 2% interest, then no matter what happens to the economy in the next 5 years, we've locked in that debt for that interest rate for a much longer time, so our debt repayments are less than they would otherwise be. It's genius, and I hope he does it.
Sounds like this mortgaging our future thing people keep talking about.
I don't know. We're going to do it anyway. It sounds a cool way to do it.
Fair enough. Might as well be upfront that we're not going to pay our debtors off. and that brings it on to my discovery. I found out about Symantec's smartphone Honeystick project, and this was a project by the Symantec information security company to find out what actually happens when you lose your phone. So they took 50 smartphones, loaded a load of dummy apps and dummy data on them, and left them in various places around North America, and saw what people actually did with them. Well, the good news of the project is 50% of them, people who found them, actually tried to return them. So that's sort of glass half full, glass half empty, I think. I think that's quite high, but other people might not. More disturbingly, 40% of people who found them tried to access online banking through it. And 96% of people tried to access some form of app through it. Although they did include contacts in that, so it could be a legitimate way of trying to contact the owner. I'm just trying to double check my numbers here. But one of them that's particularly relevant to some of the techies out there is 46% tried to access an app that they, it was an entirely spurious app they called Remote Admin. So they're trying to get into people's other computers. I mean, obviously, it was a dummy app, so it didn't do anything. So it's just a warning out there for all of you sysadmins or online bankers who have access to it through your smartphones.
Yeah.
And on average, well, the median time before any of this happening was 59 minutes. So if you lose your smartphone, you have to be able to wipe it quickly.
Obviously, you change your server password quickly.
Yeah. So that... that's all our discoveries of the fortnight.
Excellent, and as we trip and stumble over each other's punchlines, we come to the halfway point of this podcast. Still to come, there's Rants and Raves, Speak Your Brains, and the Open Ballot. Do we actually have any Speak Your Brains?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yes, we do.
We have Speak Your Brains. And that, hang on, I've completely overshot there. Rants and Raves!
Okay, all right, so it's time for Rants and Raves, yay! It's no longer a new section, so Ben is going to rant about bash scripting, I think, yes?
Yeah.
So Ben, off you go, you have 1 minute starting now.
I had to automate some tasks earlier this week, and the usual way of doing it is through bash scripting. I used to do it quite a bit, and I haven't done it for a few years, so it took a little while to refresh my memory. But come on now. It's 2012. Why do we still need such an archaic language that bears no resemblance to any other programming language ever created that I've seen? Remembering where little squiggles and brackets and semicolons go, it follows absolutely no logic whatsoever. It probably made sense when the first shells were put together 30 years ago. It doesn't make sense anymore. We've got much, much more intuitive languages available to us. Surely it's just time to put Bash to bed and say its time has passed. It served its purpose. Let's get rid of it and move on to a more modern language that's easier to understand, easier to debug. Oh my god, debugging Bash scripts is the... it makes me want to kill myself.
Don't kill yourself, Ben.
Perfect timing, Ben. I'm sorry. You should have used Python.
I should have done.
just give you that sage piece of advice. Graham now is going to rave about something.
Yes, okay.
Fantastic. Have you got a timer?
Yeah.
All right, off you go.
Well, the good ship Tux Radar is accused of being tilted direct to one side deeply in the ocean, so I'm going to readjust our balance and say that Ubuntu is fantastic and it's done great things for the Linux desktop. It wasn't so long ago, probably 6 or 7 years ago, that the Linux distribution landscape was bereft of any usability, ease of installation, hardware compatibility, and Ubuntu and Canonical for sponsoring it changed that landscape overnight. The live CD meant people could test it. It looked great. And what, more importantly, what they did is that they got Ubuntu into the press. They got Ubuntu and Linux into the press. So for a few years, Ubuntu was rising high on all this glory. Everybody was talking about it. Everybody's parents and uncles and aunts were talking about it. People knew Ubuntu. And to this day, people still know Linux through the Ubuntu brand. It's still the most likely distribution for people to try. And I really wish them all the best going forward. And thanks for all their hard effort.
That was nice, Graham.
Yeah,
that was nice. I just remember we do quite enjoy getting our listener rants or raves. So if you do want to drop a 1 minute long audio file along to my email address, jonathan.roberts@futurenet.com, then you know that'd be great. I forgot to ask last week and I missed it this time. So please do that. And that's the end. Time for Speak Your Brains.
Yep, we've got two Speak Your Brains for this episode. So thanks first to Alexander Wilms, who sent in this request. He said, "Hi, Graham. The Document Foundation applied for Google Summer of Code 2012, and they are looking for students who want to hack on the project. There are many interesting ideas that could be achieved." He's given me a link. I'll put it in the notes. "I personally suggested and designed, with the help of several other people, new UIs for picking templates and applying new table styles. If somebody wants to get involved, he or she will need to apply before the 6th of April and complete an easy hack." He says there's more information on the wiki. I'll include all the links in the podcast. So that sounds great if you want to get involved in the Summer of Code project at the Document Foundation. The other Speak Your Brains is from Peter Doggett. He says, "Hey, Graham and the team, love the podcast, so I thought I'd get in touch to let you know about my recent Linux adventures. Inspired by John's recent stint using KDE, I felt, as a long-time GNOME 2.3 and Unity user, that I'd give it a go.
Cool.
I downloaded and installed Kubuntu 11.10 on my Dell Studio 155 laptop. First impressions were that the installer is well laid out. However, it did not give an option to automatically install alongside my age-old Windows partition, which I found slightly annoying, as many other distros do." I've not had that problem. After I manually configured the partitions, it was smooth sailing from there. Everything worked out the box, updates applied and installed proprietary AMD Catalyst drivers using the tool. Only glitch I found was the stupidity of the Kubuntu devs, dev now sacked, including the Muon Software Center in the default install, even though it does not work unless you follow the instructions of the Kubuntu Bugzilla site. I have nothing else bad to say about it. In fact, I would go as far to say it's the most complete laptop distro I have ever installed. My battery lasts longer with Kubuntu than on Ubuntu. Configuration is easy, KDE is clean, cleaner, simpler, and it just works. I will most definitely be keeping it as my current distro for the time being. Thanks for your insight, guides."
That's cool. It is good to try something new from time to time.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I should switch from KDE.
You should give GNOME a go for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, how about a month with GNOME? 30 days with GNOME.
30 days with GNOME. Go for it.
It's now time for Open Ballot. We asked a question. We asked a really long question, which I'm about to pricey. If you've got nothing to hide, should you care about encrypting your data? This came on the back of an academic paper, which argues that data encryption, that is to say, full disk encryption, can significantly hamper digital investigations, potentially preventing access to all digital evidence in a case. So, if you encrypt your data, are you some evil terrorist, paedophile with things that you're ashamed of and want to keep secret, or is it actually quite natural in this data-led economy to want to keep your data safe? What does anybody think before we get into the comments?
One thing that's really interesting, a really interesting anecdote to this, is back in the day at MIT, Richard Stallman was really annoyed when they introduced passwords on computers, they seem to believe.
Really?
I think I read it in his biography. And there was quite a big uproar about the introduction of passwords to computers. It's completely, I don't know how this relates, but it's just an interesting data security anecdote.
Yeah.
Well, pretty much everybody. Everybody apart from one person on Tux Radar said that no, it is not, data encryption is not solely the preserve of people who are doing things wrong. The one person who said yes actually said no in spirit, because he said privacy is for people with something to hide, and everyone has something to hide. I hide my passport number from criminals, I hide over 18 films from my children, and I hide my bank card PIN from everybody but my wife. In other words, that's technically a yes, but essentially a no. And just to reiterate, everybody said no. Everybody said that privacy is fine.
I think we'd all say no as well, I'm guessing. And it illustrates, I think, a big division between non-technical people and the people also making the laws and the people that actually understand the technology and the kind of decisions they'd make. I mean, I have had this discussion about privacy and encryption with my parents or with my parents-in-law, and they all actually think that if you've got nothing to hide, you shouldn't worry about encrypting stuff, or you shouldn't worry about other agencies being able to read whatever it is that you're hiding, which I completely disagree with, not from any legal perspective, but I think it's my data, and it I feel safer knowing that I'm in control of my data. But they don't understand that aspect at all. And I think a lot of non-technical people will feel the same way as them. And it's the same when it comes down to copyright laws or the SOPA Act. They kind of mirror the kind of media companies or the government legislation, which doesn't have any kind of bearing on the technical side or what people within the technical industries think.
You see, I got the opposite problem because, well, not the opposite problem, but my parents-in-law, they are really conscious about how they keep the information on the computers. They do want a mechanism to keep everything safe, and they're not very technical. So, I think it's a personal right, isn't it? It's what you decide that drives you to keep all your data safe. And they're not technical. They basically use just a regular operating system without actually any real knowledge of how to keep the information safe.
But do you think they'd be concerned if there was a backdoor in their whatever security they choose that the police or the government could use to read their data?
Yeah, I think they will be concerned. Mm. Absolutely, they really want to. They think it's the privacy. It's their own right. Yeah. To exercise.
Yeah. It's just another point on the actual way the question is phrased about it being used by law enforcement. If your disk isn't encryption, then surely there's no way of knowing who actually put the data on there. If my disk is encrypted and I have nothing to hide and the police come knocking on my door, I can say, well, anything in that encrypted section, I did, because I'm the only person who knows the key. Anything outside the encryption, anyone could have put on.
Yeah, that's an interesting
Bruce Schneier says the same thing about Wi-Fi networks. You know, if you have if you have no password on your Wi-Fi network and somebody's downloaded illegal stuff, then you can just hold your hands up and say, well, anyone could have done it.
Yeah,
but now you're going to be liable with new laws for letting people download through your access
point. Not encrypting your Wi-Fi network.
Does anyone know how the new laws affect Tor exit nodes? Because
that's a really good point. And I think actually, if you actually run a Tor exit node, you'll be guilty.
I was looking into it the other day and I can't find any advice on it.
If people are using a privacy network like Tor to anonymise themselves, people, loads of volunteers run an exit node, which is basically the end of the tunnel where those private users come out. Mm. It's a bit like running an open access point, I suppose. Right. You know, so those people running the privacy nodes may become implicated in whatever crimes are done, whatever happens. It reminds me actually of the ID card argument in the UK from a few years ago. Because the country was seemingly split between those that said if you've got nothing to hide then you don't have to worry about being stopped in the street and asked for an ID card, and those people who thought that it impinged on their human rights.
The thing I find really funny about this is I very rarely hear really strong arguments for personal privacy, if you know what I mean. I genuinely do think, you know, privacy is a right and you should have it and encryption should be allowed. I do think that. But, like, if I question my philosophical basis for that, I'm not sure what argument I'm using to arrive at that, you know?
Yeah. The thing, I'm not suspicious of government, you know, and I want to let them do their job, and I feel the same about the police and the security forces as well. But what does worry me, that, say, if I've got 10 years of email in a Gmail account, it worries me that if anybody has access to that, they could make me look like anything they wanted to. There's just so much in there. They could pin anything on me, even though I've done nothing.
It was the cardinal who said, "Give me 10 lines written by any man, and I'll find something to make him guilty." Wasn't
there? Yeah, and that's, well, I don't know, but that's a great quote.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what I mean, and that's what worries me.
Right,
because so much of our lives are online, or in our phones, or on our laptops, that with so much data, I could be made to look guilty for anything.
Back to the law enforcement angle, privacy is for everyone, says Nick B. Starts off by saying, I am not a criminal. A likely story. But I will never let a uniformed police officer into my house without a warrant. We have a right to privacy, whether that makes their job harder or not, and we ought to use that right whenever we can. Fair enough. Their job should be hard.
The differences between a house and encrypted data is that if they get a warrant and you don't let them into their house, they can still get into your house. If you've encrypted their data and they come to you with a warrant and you say no, they can't get into your data. Yeah. They can throw you in prison if you don't give them a password, but they can't get into your data.
I remember watching, I think it might have been some at Stanford where they did some lectures a few years ago, and it was a famous lawyer, I think, and he recommended if you ever you, the police come to you and ask you about a crime, don't ever say anything. It doesn't matter if you're innocent. The more information you give them about anything, the more liable you're making yourself open for prosecution. Really? And it's the same with this. And even though it goes against, even though you want to do the right thing and give the police your information, in actually telling them more, you're giving them more to make you guilty of something. Yeah. And even though it feels wrong and it feels selfish, I don't know what the right answer is, actually.
That's the one thing I felt was missing in the comments, and Andrew's read them closer than I have. But I didn't, like I said, you know, I don't see the really strong argument for privacy or, you know, in favour of encryption. I don't see a really rigorous argument that would make me believe it either way. It makes me think it's more of a belief or an issue of, you know, social conditioning of how you've been brought up, rather than necessarily an obviously right or wrong situation.
In the US, wasn't there a story where somebody was asked to give them their password to their encrypted archive, and the person said no, saying that it could potentially be self-incriminating, and you don't have to actually purge yourself. Yeah, and I don't think it was, I can't remember, but I don't think it worked. I think in the end he was found guilty of withholding evidence or whatever it might have been, despite the fact that he shouldn't be exactly.
It's interesting.
Well, we're about to get chucked out of this meeting room. So that brings us to the end of the somewhat misaptly named open ballots. We all know what John and Graham think. However, if you want to find out what any of the readers think, you've got to go to tuxradar.com and read the comments. That more or less brings us to the end of the podcast as well. Bye.